This recording is starting late because I stupidly forgot to turn on the recorder. So if we judge whether life is infinitely valuable by looking at private decisions, the answer is we don't act that way. Think about what your life would be like. Let's not even make it infinite. Suppose you thought of your life as worth $100 billion to you, and you're making rational choices on that basis. How would your life be different than it now is? How would your behavior be different? What? If you thought your life was enormously valuable, 100 billion infinity, I don't much care for a moment. Make it infinity. How would you live differently if you said, I'm going to act as if my life had that value?
I wouldn't be in school.
Is school dangerous?
You're trying to maximize your enjoyment while you're alive.
No, I'm not talking about enjoyment. I'm talking about life. You're maximizing your life expectancy. You're willing to pay any price, or at least an enormously high price, to reduce by even a very, very small amount your chance of dying today. And the same thing tomorrow and the next day. So what are the things you could do that would reduce your chance of dying?
Prevent.
What?
Yourself from driving.
Yeah, the most obvious thing is not to take trips, not to do any driving at all, any traveling, unless the traveling produces a benefit for your for life expectancy, so that you would drive to the doctor if you wasn't in walking distance. If you did have to travel, you would always fly instead of driving for any long distance, because we know that the mortality rate per mile is much lower for airplanes than for cars. You would consume medical services up to the point where you really believed they were useless, even if that result was that you couldn't afford to go to movies or have nice clothes or do other things that you valued. You would presumably work pretty hard as long as it wasn't in ways that risked your life, because money can be translated into more life in various ways. You wouldn't be a skydiver, a skier, or a snowboarder. You would probably pay a lot more attention than most of us do to your weight. That's one of the variables that we have pretty good reason to believe is going to affect life expectancy. Oh, there's some argument about the range. Nutrition in general, you'd probably be one of these crazy people who spends a lot of time figuring out what vitamins you should have and what's the latest evidence on whether antioxidants do or don't increase life. And all sorts of, it's just, you can imagine the kind of life somebody would lead, and it doesn't describe many people that we know. So the actual behavior suggests that we treat life as very important, but not as infinitely important. On the other hand, the proof that life is infinitely valuable is very simple. We believe in measuring value by revealed preference in economics, by what offers people accept. I'm offering you money to buy your heart tomorrow or even today. What price will you accept for your heart? I got somebody who needs a heart transplant. He's wealthy. He's willing to give you $100 million for your heart. Is it a deal? Anyone in the room want to sell his heart for $100 million? What? No. Can you imagine anybody who would? Who are the people who would?
People that are in poverty, let's say their families.
It's the second part that's critical.
Yeah.
The critical point is the person who did it would either be somebody who was planning to commit suicide anyway, yeah, whose life was valueless, or somebody who had something really important to him to spend the money on that didn't depend on his being alive. All right. So that the critical argument I want to make is the fact that you won't, that none of us will sell our hearts for $100 million, is showing not that your life is infinitely valuable, but that $100 million would be worthless to you. All right? Because you can't spend it once you're dead. And that where we do observe people who are willing to accept something close to selling their heart, it's because they think that there is some benefit. I'm thinking of things like soldiers in World War I who were sometimes in situations where they knew they were very unlikely to survive, or fighter pilots in World War II. I think the RAF fighter pilots, I don't know what the rate is, but my impression is that very definitely a minority of them survived the war. But those people think that there is something they can buy with their life that doesn't depend on their being alive to enjoy it, such as saving. So I want to argue that in fact the paradox that you won't sell your heart for $100 million and yet you act in your individual decisions as if life was worth much less than that to you really is the same point we made when we were talking about efficiency, that we're measuring value in dollars but dollars are an imperfect measure of value because the same dollar may represent different amounts of happiness to different people. And I now say, not only does it represent different happiness to different people, which is sort of hard to observe because I'm only one person making choices, it represents different amounts of happiness to me in different circumstances. And the extreme case is that a dollar received immediately after I die represents no happiness at all to me unless I have other people who I can spend the money on. All right? So that means that whereas normally how many dollars you would give for it is a good measure of how valuable it is, how many dollars would you give for it under circumstances where you can't spend the money is a very poor measure of how valuable it is. And one way of getting around that problem is to think about it in terms of selling very low risks, of saying how much will you accept for one chance in a million of dying or one chance in a thousand of dying, because the nice thing about one chance in a thousand of dying is that you have 999 chances in a thousand of being alive to spend the money. All right? Is that argument? Does that make intuitive sense to people? That if you ask why is it that we observe so much higher a value for life if we want to buy a heart than if we only want to hire you to drive a dynamite truck? And the answer is because if you drive a dynamite truck, at the end of the day, you'll probably be alive to spend your higher wages, whereas if you sell your heart, the next day, there's nothing you can do with the money. It's a pretty simple argument that I think is useful. And I want to claim that if for 5 minutes we stop being economists who measure things in dollars and become philosophers who measure things in utiles and human happiness, that then thinking about the value of your life in terms of how you would price it when you were accepting a very small risk is the right way to do it, because after all, if we spend money in order to keep you alive, that's money that would otherwise go either to you or to somebody else in circumstances where he's alive to enjoy it, and therefore the right measure of the utility of the dollar to use is not the utility of a dollar to a corpse, but the utility of a dollar to a living person. That's my argument. You persuaded or not? If you're entirely persuaded, think about that coal mine accident again and try to figure out why we don't feel that way then, because I don't have a good answer. So how would we actually measure the value of life? And the way people have done it, I should say, there are various economists and such have tried to make estimates. Yep.
At least one difference maybe with the coal accident is that with the risk of like driving a dynamite truck, that's not a certainty, that's an unknown probability versus the...
It is clear why the guy who's trapped in the coal mine would be willing to spend everything he owns to get out, because if he dies, the money's of no use to him anyway. But the question is, why are other people willing to spend a large amount? Because if he dies, they'll still have the money to spend on themselves or on other things they value. If you think about the difference between dollars to a corpse and dollars to somebody else, and they're really different units, even though they're the same pieces of green paper, the dollars we're spending saving the guy in the coal mine accident aren't dollars that would otherwise go to a corpse. Anyway, you can think about it. So the one of the standard ways that people do it is they look at professions that are otherwise similar. That's my driving a dynamite truck versus driving an ordinary truck. And I don't know if that's a real example or not. But if you take a profession which differs from its standard version only in that you're much more likely to get killed, you then ask how much higher are the wages you have to pay people to get them to accept such risks. And there are a couple of problems, one of which would occur to anybody but an economist and one of which would occur to nobody but an economist. The one that would occur to anybody but an economist is, can you really assume that people know what the risk is of driving a dynamite truck or whatever? Are they well informed, making rational choices? And the economist tends to assume they are. But the one which only occurs to the economists is to say, wait a minute, people who drive dynamite trucks are not a random sample of truck drivers. Who are the truck drivers who are willing to drive dynamite trucks? I'm assuming dynamite trucks go off with some frequency.
People who have lower estimations of the value of their own.
That's right. Could also be somebody who's optimistic about the dynamite truck, about the safety of the truck. But it's going to be a biased sample in that out of all the drivers, the ones you hire are the ones who will do it for the lowest wage premium. And therefore, that's not really a measure of the average value of life in as much as value of life is one of the things goes into the wage premium. So maybe you ought to think of the calculation there as sort of a lower bound for the value of life. That's the value of life to people who have below average value for their own lives. Have any of you read the book Snow Crash? You have?
Yeah.
You remember the pizza delivery at the beginning?
Where he's got the katana.
Well, he has the
on, or this is in the first world, but in the real world.
In the real world, that's right. The very beginning, opening scene, the protagonist of the book, whose name happens to be Hero Protagonist, this is a very tongue-in-cheek book, but it's actually quite a lot of fun. It's a sort of a fair, not very far future SF. And he's a pizza delivery man. All right? However, pizza delivery is a job that in this particular future has been taken over by the mafia. And the way the mafia does pizza delivery is that when the pizza comes out of the oven, a little timer is activated, and the mafia guarantees to the customers that the pizza will reach them within 30 minutes of coming out of the oven. And if it doesn't, the head of the mafia will come to the customer and apologize. And the head of the mafia really doesn't like to have to apologize. And the result is that being a pizza delivery driver is a really high tension, high risk, exotic kind of activity because, A, you've got to get it there in that 30 minutes, and there's a suspicion that you'll get murdered if you don't. That's why Hero Protagonist is delivering pizzas, because he's a guy who likes the fun of risk and tension and such. And in this world, pizza delivery is that kind of a job, right? Which is, as I say, the author is having fun, but it also makes the legitimate point that you might have people who take risky jobs because the risk is itself something they enjoy, aside from the effect of value of life. So you could also look at other choices, such as if some cars are safer than others, are people willing to pay how much more for them, how much are people willing to pay for extra medical checkups and so forth. And I'm not up on this. My figures may be 15 years out of date, but at least when I looked at the literature, there's a book by Kip Disguzi which covers this, and my memory was that the typical estimates are sort of $1 to $10 million is what people, Americans, acted as if their lives were. In tort law, my favorite example of what is wrong with Posner's conjecture that common law is economically efficient is that in traditional common law, the value of life was zero. Why is that? Because in tort law, your claim dies with you, and therefore there's no one else to sue. And in the course of the 19th century, various states passed what I think were called survivor statutes. And what they basically said was that if you were tortiously killed, your wife or maybe your kids could sue for the loss to them due to your being killed. So that's loss of consortium, which presumably is whatever wives get from husbands and husbands get from wives, which is sort of a mixed bag of sex and cooking and hugging and a bunch of other things. Loss of your value as a wage earner for your family, presumably net of your own consumption. And if you think about that, that's really bizarre. Because almost certainly what is the largest single element, if you think about your life, I will assume that you're all nice people who have friends, and your friends value your life and would be upset if you died. I mean, I certainly was very upset when a close friend died a year or two ago. Who is the person in the world who you think values your life most? Most of everybody in the world? Why? I didn't say any except for. I made no exceptions. Who values your life most? Almost certainly, yeah. It's conceivable that your parents do. You could imagine a case where your parents were willing to make more sacrifices to keep you alive than you were. But I think a good rough rule of thumb for each human being is that the person who values his life most is him. And he probably values it much more than even those near and dear to him do. And we regard it as sort of extraordinary when somebody's willing to sacrifice his life for somebody else, although you occasionally do see it happening. That completely is left out of the standard legal definition of damages for tortious loss of life. So that at least in theory, I'm not sure what a court would really do, but at least in theory, if you're a loner, if you are somebody, you live a happy, successful life, you're retired, and live on your savings, but, you know, what do? You watch television, you read books, you have no friends. You know, you're sort of an odd guy. Nobody really much will notice if you die. except for whoever has to deal with the money. As I understand current legal doctrine, your life is worthless, and if somebody carelessly runs you down, if O.J. Simpson murders you and manages to get acquitted for the murder, when he's convicted for the tortious loss of life, damages are zero. All right? Very weird. Very weird rule. And there is an alternative, which I don't believe any state in the U.S. actually has implemented, though again I could be wrong, but which some legal theorists have argued for and which appeals to economists, and that's what's called hedonic damages. And do you know what hedonism is? What's hedonism?
Living a life where you're just kind of indulging in physical pleasure.
That's right. Hedonism is sort of the philosophy that you should have as much pleasure in life as possible. And it comes from a Greek word which I don't know, but which has to do with pleasure. So hedonic damages means think about the lost pleasure in the case of losing a life, what you lose through not living the rest of your life, which is all the enjoyment you would have had in the rest of your life. And so the argument then is that a standard economic argument on tort damages is we want people to internalize the externality, we want other people to have an incentive to take precautions not to kill you whenever the precautions cost less than the value of life saved. Well, the value of life saved consists mainly of the pleasure you have living your life, and therefore that ought to be included. And so that suggests that even though we can't compensate you for being killed, we can give other people the right incentive not to kill you by damages. And this, of course, is suggesting a point I'll get to a little bit more later, the general tension in tort law between thinking of tort damages as compensation and thinking of tort damages as punishment for tortfeasors. And the language, I think, is more in compensation, whereas the economic view tends to be more in terms of damages. And in fact, as we'll be seeing later, I think I mentioned earlier, you can also think of tort damages as playing a third role. Right? Which isn't discussed in this chapter, but we discussed later, one role of tort damages is that they give people an incentive not to commit torts. One reason is they compensate the victim. What else do tort damages do? One most important to you, professionally speaking. They give an incentive to prove that somebody's committed a tort. Imagine that our legal system was changed in a way that effectively eliminated tort damages. You can think of different things. Workers' compensation, in a sense, does that for a certain area. You people would be making a terrible mistake in becoming lawyers. Right? Because the total demand for, I don't know how big it is, but let me suppose the total demand for lawyers would drop 30%, and you people would all come up, graduate, and be unemployed. And so clearly, one way of thinking of tort law is it's a bounty system, just like $100 dead or alive, only this time it's $100,000 for proving that somebody did something tortious. One way of thinking of it is compensation, and one way of thinking of it is punishment. And it isn't too surprising that if you put that big a load on a single number, namely the amount of damages, it can't carry the load, and then it's very hard to set up a system which really does the right job for all three of those purposes. So suppose we just think about the incentive versus insurance tension, that you can think of tort damages as compensation for the victim or as punishment for the tortfeasor. And the problem with thinking of it in those two ways is that the right value of those numbers is entirely different. They're not even related to each other. And if you think about the loaner, if you ask the loaner not how much is your life worth, but how much would you like to insure your life for, what would his answer be? No one's dependent on him. No one he cares about. His life's over. World's over for him. How much money does he want to spend on life insurance when he could be spending that money on sushi? None. Zero, right? So his optimal level of life insurance is zero. And therefore, if you think of the tort system, as people often do, as compensating, it makes perfectly good sense to say that when you tortiously kill him, the damages are zero. On the other hand, his life is still very valuable to him. I mean, he really likes sushi and reading good books and watching movies and stuff. And if we want to give people an incentive not to kill him, we ought to treat the damages as quite substantial. So that's a particular example of something which is true quite generally, that the optimal level of insurance against tort damages, against being injured by a tort, is not the same as the optimal level of punishment for injuring someone through a tort, and yet tort damages are we try to use to do both jobs. Is that problem clear? So imagine for a moment, this is getting ahead of me, but it's sort of one way of thinking about it. You're the loner, and suppose somebody tells you, by the way, they've recently introduced hedonic damages in our state, and if someone tortiously kills you, you or your estate is going to get $5 million. What might be a sensible thing for you to do, assuming the legal system let you do it? Well, you certainly want everybody, but everybody's going to know about the change in the legal system. What are you going to do with this hypothetical $5 million? You bury it with you? And can you think of anything better to do with it than have it put into your grave? If you get tortiously killed. Let us assume unrealistically that the chance of being tortiously killed is significant, that it's 1% or 5% or something, enough so you can think about it. And you say, all right, I've got to make it 10%. You say, I've got one chance in 10 that I will be tortiously killed, and about the point they're having my funeral, the lawyers will arrive with a $10 million stack of money. What ought I to do? What arrangements should I make now to deal with that $10 million? Anybody? Be ingenious, you know, create new systems, new institutions. Yeah, it's got nothing to do with it.
I'd sell the right to somebody.
You'd sell the right to collect the $10 million, precisely. That's exactly right. You would say, look, here is going to be $10 million worthless to me. It won't be worthless to other people. And it's not worthless to me now. $10 million, one chance in 10, that's $1 million. I can do a lot of things with $1 million. I'm going to find a buyer, and I will say, I'm going to sign over to you the right to collect damages if I am killed. How much will you pay for it? And you auction it off, and you get a buyer who will offer you something close to $1 million. $1 million worth of sushi, you can have a pretty good life. And with luck, you don't get killed. And if you do get killed, at least you've enjoyed yourself until you got killed. Does that make sense?
Avoid the puffer fish.
Avoid the what?
Avoid the puffer fish.
Yeah, right. That's true. Unless you're very confident of the chef. And he eats first. The puffer fish badly prepared is poisonous. Very, very poisonous. But it's supposed to be very good. All right, so that seems to me is the right answer. And a different way of putting that answer is, suppose I asked you a different question. If you knew that you were going to receive $10 million if you died, and putting aside the fact you could die of lots of things other than torts, how much life insurance would you want? We said before you don't want any life insurance, and I claim that's too high a figure. If you're going to have $10 million arrive in your estate when you die, and you have no use for money after you're dead, what's the optimal amount of life insurance for you to have? Anybody? Two days after you're dead, how much money do you want to have?
None.
How do we arrange that? The day after you die, $10 million arrives from the lawyers. A day after you die, your life insurance policy pays off. In order that those two numbers total to zero, what must be the amount of life insurance you have?
$10 million plus X equals zero. X equals? Very good. Minus $10 million.
I thought of that, but it somehow felt ridiculous to suggest a negative number.
That's a mistake. Keep thinking when it feels ridiculous. Right? So what you want is to have minus $10 million worth of life insurance, and that's precisely what you just proposed. Right? It wasn't the form of life insurance because it was just in the tortious case, but you proposed that you sell your damages in advance to someone else. Isn't that, supposing for a moment that the only way you can die is tortiously, which is obviously not true, then isn't that equivalent to your taking out minus $10 million worth of life insurance. And just as you pay positive amounts for positive life insurance, someone else will pay you for the negative life insurance, because the negative life insurance means he gets paid by you negative, when you die.
Negative in the sense that it essentially takes the right to the $10 million away from you.
It's negative in the sense that instead of you being paid money when you die, you pay money when you die. Except that it's only in the case where you die tortiously. Yeah. So what the argument suggests is we observe that I want to make the argument more general. I sort of jumped ahead because I thought it was a useful way of making the point, that the rule we're often told in tort damage is to make the victim whole. And that sounds like about the right rule for Pigouvian incentives, because that means that the tortfeasor has to pay for the amount of damage he did, although there are problems if you're not don't always convict people and stuff. The question is, when is make the victim whole the right rule for insurance? And I want to claim that when you're talking about monetary losses, it is indeed the right rule. Because if you think about the amount of insurance you would want, what you're really doing is transferring money among possible futures when you buy insurance. You're making yourself poorer in the future where your house doesn't burn down, richer in the house where the future where you do. When do you want to transfer a dollar? You want to transfer a dollar from a future where the dollar has less value to you to one where it has more. That argument makes sense. If all we're talking about is money, the more money you have, the less value of a dollar to you. So therefore, if you keep shifting money between futures, as long as it's more valuable in one than another, you stop at the point where you end up with the same amount of money in both futures. That argument makes sense. Doesn't make sense. Well, how much sense it makes depends on how good your math intuition is.
People vary on that a lot. But this may or may not help. But suppose we think about your marginal utility of income, which is how much you value one per dollar. And suppose we believe that typically it declines with your income. So this is your income, and this is the marginal utility of a dollar. And we say the less money you have, the more each dollar is worth. And we say, well, look, we've got two possible futures. This is the future you want, where the house doesn't burn down, and this is the future you don't want, where the house does burn down. And you say, well, in this future, money's only that value to me in this future, so I'd like to transfer a dollar from this future to that one, which I do by buying insurance. Now, it's a little tricky because what I'm really doing is paying a dollar to get $1,000 with one chance in $1,000. So that I'm really talking as though they're equally likely, which they are. But conceptually, I'm transferring money between the low value use and high value use. Perfectly sensible thing to do. Well, I say the result of my transferring is now that if the house doesn't burn down, I'm only going to have this much money. Because I'm spending some money on fire. On the other hand, if it does burn down, I'm going to have this much because I'm getting the insurance payment when it burns down. When does the process stop? At this point, it's still the case that if it burns down, money will be worth more to you than if it doesn't. So you keep running that process through until you get to the point where you're just as well off if it burns down or doesn't burn down. At that point, there's no reason to transfer anything between the two. All right? That's the basic logic of it. Now, obviously, it's complicated by the fact that insurance companies have to pay their rent, so therefore it really costs more than a dollar to transfer a dollar, but you could modify it for this. But what that suggests is that, roughly speaking, the make the victim whole is just about the right rule for insurance if the losses are in money. Because if the losses are in money, if you were buying insurance, you would want to buy just about enough insurance to replace your house. Because that's the point at which the marginal value to you of another dollar is about what it is in the alternative future where it doesn't burn down, which is the one where you're paying for the insurance. Make sense? Not make sense? What I want to claim, however, is that argument does not apply for non-monetary losses. And the reason is that something like getting blinded, crippled, or killed not only costs you money, it also affects your ability to turn money into happiness. So think about something like losing your eyesight or being crippled.
much. I'm going to claim our less extreme versions of getting killed, that they raise the same kind of issue. That if I lose my, if I'm blinded or crippled, that creates a new cost which can be paid with money, like a guide dog or a wheelchair. Even if those are provided, even if I have a good wheelchair or if I've got a guide dog, I'm still certainly worse off than if I hadn't been crippled or blinded, right? Very few of us would be willing to say, I'll give up my vision if you'll just give me a good guide dog for free. But in addition to making me worse off, it also may well make me less able to turn money into happiness. Because after all, what I used to do was to spend money going skiing, and that's not really an option when you're either blind or crippled. I exaggerate a little bit. I've seen a one-legged skier. It's unusual, but it hasn't been done. And so imagine for a moment that we took seriously the idea of making the victim whole in the utility sense. So we said, we're going to have a level of tort damages such that if you're blinded, you won't mind. Such that if you're blinded, you will be given enough money to make you as well off as if you hadn't been blinded. So coin flip whether you're blind and rich or not blind and not rich. How would you do it? If you try to imagine doing that, it wouldn't be just compensate you because you can't do your job, compensate you for your medical costs and your guide dog. It would have to be also provide you whatever things you could value to filter, to make up for all the stuff you couldn't have anymore. So you would be eating, if you liked food, you'd be eating in luxury restaurants practically every day. You would have a masseuse come in to rub your shoulders on a regular basis. I don't know what you would have. It would depend on your tastes and luxuries. You would have somebody reading books to you if you couldn't read anymore. But whatever you would have, it would involve consuming things that gave you pleasure, which weren't worth consuming before you were blinded, because there were better ways of getting pleasure. They had less payoff per dollar than your normal consumption. But you can't do those things anymore, and so in order to push your happiness back up, if it was doable at all, and it presumably might be doable if crippled means that your left hand doesn't work very well anymore, much harder if it means that you're blind or in a wheelchair or something. But if you try to imagine a level of insurance or tort damages such that you don't care if the injury happens, it would have to involve a lot of what we would normally think of as very wasteful spending, in the sense of spending a whole lot of money to get you a little bit of pleasure. So that would mean that you wouldn't buy insurance at that level. Because if you had a level of insurance for being crippled which paid you the $50 million a year that you needed to be as happy as if you hadn't been crippled, you would say to yourself, look, $40 million a year, I'll be nearly as happy with $50 million, and that $10 million a year would be much more useful to me if I'm not crippled, therefore I'm not going to buy that extra insurance. Does that logic make sense? And you would take it down, we don't know how far you would take it down. But the argument is that you would practically never want to buy insurance up to the level that fully compensated you for the loss, although for a house burning you down, you would. I can't tell if silence means this is obvious or it means I've completely lost everybody, so maybe you can give me a hint. Anybody? The bottom line I'm trying to argue is that if you're thinking of tort damages in terms of optimal insurance, you don't want them high enough to fully compensate the victim for damages to the victim, but you do for monetary losses. And that's an argument I'm trying to make. Do people see why that argument makes sense or not? Because the non-monetary losses reduce ways in which you can take that money you're paid and convert it into happiness, which means that in order to get your happiness up as high as it used to be, you'll have to use less good ways than you used to use converting money into happiness, which means a dollar is giving you less happiness per dollar than in the uncrippled state, which means you shouldn't be transferring the monies from the uncrippled to the crippled state, which is what the insurance is doing. So, and the extreme case is the loner who gets killed, where in his case he has no ability at all to transfer money, to convert dollars into happiness, and therefore he would want zero insurance. So people think about tort damages as doing two things at once. One of them is getting the marginal utility of income equal between the state of the world where you are not injured and where you are, which I'm claiming is the optimal level of insurance, because you want to keep transferring money between the states of the between future states of the world until a dollar is equally valuable each place, because if not, you should move it from where a dollar is less valuable to you to where it's more valuable. And that would be zero insurance from a hypothetical loaner. But you also want the right level of damages paid, meaning a level of damages that reflects the real cost that the tortfeasor commits by imposing a risk on you. The tortfeasor is deciding to do something to remove rocks with dynamite instead of with muscle power. And he knows or should know that there's some very small chance that something will go wrong and a chunk of rock will fly onto your property and hit you in the head and kill you. And you would like him, in deciding whether to use dynamite, to use in the calculation the value you would use if you were deciding whether to use dynamite. That is to say, how much do I have to save in money to be willing to accept a certain small risk of death? So that means that the right level of damages would get your utility ex ante before the gamble is actually taken, the same whether or not the risk is imposed. And that's the right Pigouvian. And that's much more than zero for the loaner. And then the bottom line is we can't do both of those things at once with tort damages. And my claim is that we can do both of those things at once if we're allowed to have both tort damages and insurance, as in my case where the loaner is going to be paid lots of money if he dies, but he's allowed to sell that insurance in advance to somebody else, so he actually gets to consume the money when he's alive. And in any case, I want to claim that we shouldn't think of tort as insurance because it's lousy insurance. And it's lousy insurance for three different reasons, only two of which are on the PowerPoint. One reason why tort is lousy insurance is that the insurance you want doesn't depend on whether the damage is tortious. What you would like is insurance against being injured, not insurance against being injured by rocks flying through a dynamite, blowing up rocks with dynamite, right? Furthermore, you don't care for insurance purposes whether it's someone else's fault or just a bolt of lightning that injured you. You'd like it protecting against both, so tort does it poorly. And there's actually a third point, and you don't care whether it depends on whether the tortfeasor is judgment-proof. But the final point, which I don't mention here, is that an insurance company has at least some incentive to want to pay you. Because while it's true they don't like paying out money, they do like to have the reputation of paying out money. All right, an insurance company wants the reputation that when their customers are injured, they're gladly paying. What does a tort lawyer want? What does a tort defense lawyer want as a reputation? Does he want the reputation that when his that when his client is sued, he's glad to pay off damages? Some of you may be in this business. Is that what you want to do? No, you want the opposite reputation. You want to say he's a miser, he's an SOB, you're going to have to squeeze that money out of him, it'll cost you a fortune, you better not sue him at all. All right? But that means that the tort system is going to be a more expensive way of providing insurance than the insurance system is. Because in the tort system, to get your payoff, you've got to fight for it, as it were. The insurance system, you've got to worry the guy will try to cheat you, but at least he wants the reputation of not doing so. It makes life easier for you. So my claim is that the right way to solve this paradox is to use tort damages for the disincentive. If you want more insurance than the tort damages give you, you buy it. And if you want less, you sell insurance on yourself. So how would you do that? You would do it by allowing people to sell tort claims that haven't occurred yet, to sell inchoate tort claims. I think there are arguments for letting people sell tort claims in general. That's a broader issue. But the particular argument is that if I am tortiously killed, you get to sue for the value of my life to me, and in exchange you pay me now the average that you'll collect from that, and I get to spend it now and I'm alive to spend the money. So that's my optimal system. I don't know if it's institutionally practical, but I think that theoretically it nicely shows what's going on with tort law and why it's important. So the summary of this argument is that if we want people to have the correct incentive in imposing risks on others, that is the same incentive as in taking precautions for themselves, we want to make them liable for the ex post damages, calculating life in terms of what you have to pay to accept risks. All right. Make the damage claims marketable. And now, ex ante, I'm fully compensated. Ex post, I'm not fully compensated. But then I can't be fully compensated for being killed ex post because I don't have any use for the money. But you understand what I mean by ex ante compensation? I mean that if you're looking at before the tort occurs, you're saying, in order, I don't want to be compensated for being killed. That's not an option. I want to be compensated for having one chance in a thousand of being killed, because that's what dynamite's going to do. So ex ante compensation means I'm as well off if I have one chance in a thousand of being killed but have some money than if I didn't have that one chance in a thousand of having been killed and wasn't paid the money. So complete ex ante compensation is such that I say, I'm indifferent. I don't care whether you blast with dynamite or not, because if you blast with dynamite, I'm going to get paid $15, because that's going to increase the value of my tort claims that I'm going to sell to somebody else. Hard to set up institutionally, but logically it seems to me it's the right concept for what the right damages are. And doing that gives the right disincentive, because people only impose risks if it saves them more than it costs the victim. And it also gets the right level of insurance, because people are then free to adjust their insurance up or down on the insurance market by buying or selling insurance on themselves. Any questions? All right, so that's the basic argument here on what the value of life is, and on why it seems problematic between selling your heart and taking risks, and on how one could imagine a tort system that fully allowed for that problem.